At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where long-term performance is driven by original, fundamental research on a global scale. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
What we have here, folks, is the classic half-empty, half-full conundrum. And what you think depends in part on who you listen to. The economic message out of Washington today was half-full and rising, but slowly. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at cargill.com/creates. American Public Media presents the Poetry Radio Project. You can hear unique perspectives on global events and American culture at americanpublicmedia.org/poetry.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday, today the 14th of April. So glad you could be with us. You can't really call them dueling speeches because, of course, whenever the president speaks, he gets top billing. But in a matching pair of what you might call cautious remarks today, both the president of the United States and the chairman of the Federal Reserve made their case that the economy's glass is half full. The president repeated his line from last week that there are glimmers of hope out there. In a separate appearance, Ben Bernanke said he sees tentative signs the economy's decline is slowing. You wouldn't know it from the tumbling retail sales numbers out today or the unexpected drop in producer prices. Wholesale inflation is another way to say that. And that seems to be what Wall Street is focused on. Still, our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports economic policymakers are trying to tell us the worst might be over.
Answering questions from students at Morehouse College in Atlanta today, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke said it's important to restore people's confidence that things are getting better.
As the economy begins to improve, as I believe it will, as the financial markets begin to improve, as they will if we maintain these policies effectively, then people will begin to see that the situation is beginning to stabilize. I think that will be very helpful.
Bernanke told the students recent improvements in home sales, home building, and consumer spending mean the economic decline has leveled off, which he said is the first step toward recovery. Princeton's Alan Blinder, a former vice chairman of the Fed, says both Bernanke and President Obama realize there are plenty of hard times ahead, notably higher unemployment. But he says policy leaders are trying to avoid talking down the economy.
The more gloom and doom that comes out of the people in authority, the worse that is for confidence, both consumer confidence and for business confidence.
Blinder says the leader's cautious optimism is based on substance. Lower interest rates and lower housing prices are having a positive effect on the economy. Economist Alan Levinson at T. Rowe Price agrees, but he also recognizes the risk of accentuating the positive.
Where you're playing with fire is if you say these sorts of things when they're not justified, when you're hoping rather than observing. But I think at least that they're making some fact-based observations.
Levinson says over time, the tenor of comments from policy decision makers can improve the economy's performance. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Courtesy of the Wall Street Journal today, we've got the name of the latest nominee for a high-level Treasury Department job. The paper says Herb Allison, the CEO of Fannie Mae, could be in line to run the bank bailout, also known as TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program. Treasury is not confirming anything at all, but the leak does highlight an ongoing problem for the department. With fixing the financial crisis at the top of a very long list of things to do, Treasury still has more than a dozen top-level positions unfilled. Tamara Keith reports.
The Treasury Department is looking for a few undersecretaries, assistant secretaries, and inspectors, 13 in all. James Barth is a finance fellow at the Milken Institute. And kidding aside, he says those open positions are critical.
Given all the problems, this is a time to get people in place as soon as possible.
But he says the vetting process is intense and often invasive. That's a deterrent for all those jobless Wall Street executives who could make excellent candidates.
You don't want to screen too carefully if you're looking for firemen when houses are burning down. You want to get as many competent people working to put out the fires as possible.
While the fires are still burning, the hours are likely to be long. The pay won't even come close to Wall Street wages. That doesn't sound very appealing. Professor Kevin Jakes of Baldwin Wallace College worked at Treasury for 14 years. He says these jobs offer something else, a chance to make a difference.
They give you an opportunity to work with some of the best and the brightest policymakers in this country working on issues of incredible importance.
A Treasury official insisted the pace of filling positions requiring Senate confirmation isn't an issue. But NYU government professor Paul Light says right now Secretary Geithner needs some key people.
The political appointees who have the authority to pull triggers on major policy decisions. That's the serious problem that he faces.
Right now, Light says Geithner is pulling almost every trigger on his own. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, the glasses were most definitely half empty. We will have the details when we do the numbers. American Airlines is set to report first quarter profits tomorrow. If early indications are any guide, it's not going to be pretty. American and United and all the rest of the big airlines are expected to report losses in the many billions of dollars over the next week or 10 days. That might not jive with what passengers are seeing, namely airplanes packed as full as they can be. So we have called aviation analyst Richard Abulafia to ask why that is. Mr. Abulafia, good to have you with us.
Pleasure to be here.
Gas is cheap, planes are full, and yet the major carriers in this country are about to report earnings that are billions of dollars in the hole.
Well, numbers are actually way down. Even though the planes are full, that's only because the airlines have been able to shrink themselves in line with slack passenger traffic demand.
That is to say people aren't flying, but is that corporate or consumers? Because if I'm paying for the ticket, there are some deals out there.
Well, it's pretty strange. Normally, when you have slack numbers like these, it's the back of the plane, consumer demand, that leads the problem. But this time around, business demand has actually been the problem. That's not to say that consumer demand is holding up great. It's just that businesses have really led the way in cutting back.
And yet, I read this morning that Delta is still expecting, despite a quarterly loss that it's about to report, it's still expecting to make money for the whole year. How can that be?
Well, there's a general feeling, just like with the rest of the economy, that passenger travel demand has hit rock bottom, but we're clawing our way back. So even though the numbers you're seeing out of the airlines are bad, there's a feeling that this is as bad as it gets, and there will be signs of recovery after this.
Which is to say summertime demand, yes?
Summertime demand, holiday travel demand, plus generally just a feeling that the economy had a heart attack in the fourth quarter of last year, first quarter of this year, and we're recovering from that. Bans on travel by companies and governments are being relaxed. People are starting to spend discretionary income on travel again. You're seeing signs of a life.
I've been talking mostly about the big name carriers. What about the smaller, more regional airlines in this country? How might they be doing?
In general, traffic is down for everybody. It's a very difficult environment for the regional players. The low-cost carriers generally have been faring a little bit better than the majors, especially Southwest, that always somehow pulls ahead of everybody. But still, with traffic declines like these that you've seen over the past 6 months, it's safe to say that nobody is truly prospering.
Here's the million-dollar question, though. When are they going to start putting more airplanes on these routes so we don't all get stuck in the middle of a three- or four-seat combination on those packed airplanes?
The problem is that given the fares and where pricing is heading, which is straight down, the only way to make money is by keeping planes as full as possible. And even there, despite how crowded it seems, they haven't fully been able to keep pace with declining traffic numbers. So it might seem like an illusion, but in reality, load factors, the percent of each plane that's filled, they've actually declined a little bit.
So what I hear you saying, though, is that we might actually find more full planes, fewer planes on the routes and more people on those planes.
You know, a few years ago, nobody knew that airlines could routinely charge $250 for cross-country round-trip flights and still survive as a business, and yet they are. And part of that, of course, is that they're really good at filling planes. Their only hope, unless that pricing improves, their only hope is to keep those planes as full as possible.
Mr. Abulafia, thanks very much for your time.
Oh, really a pleasure.
The economic optimism that was coming out of official Washington today was nowhere to be seen last fall. Back in October, the vibe was more, how bad can it possibly get? So we set about figuring out whether Wall Street was leading this country down the road to ruin. Marketplace's Amy Scott and Tess Vigeland are off on a new set of travels. Amy was in Charlotte, North Carolina yesterday. That's home to a big chunk of the U.S. banking industry. We'll get her update in just a bit. Tess spent the night in Lincoln, Nebraska, where she had dinner with the Landis McKibben family, just like she did in October.
Life and dinner seem pretty much like they were 6 months ago at the home of Dave and Melody Landis. On the menu in October, chicken and gravy. Last night, a frugal staple at the table, which daughter Melissa, a 36-year-old environmental specialist with the local utility, assured us signified nothing.
Actually, I got all sorts of grief because I made macaroni and cheese tonight, and all sorts of people were like, hey, you know, if you put hot dogs in that, it'll go a little further.
It's not the economy, she says. It's my 8-year-old daughter, Naomi. As we sat down, I asked Melody, a professor at the University of Nebraska, how the economy has treated the family since last October.
Well, I think relatively well in comparison to some people in this country, wouldn't you say, folks?
Yes, definitely.
In fact, Lincoln was recently listed in a national magazine as one of the good places to ride out a recession. State government and university jobs are holding steady, as are property values. And Nebraska was the only state in the country where unemployment dropped from January to February of this year. But there was a narrow escape recently for the Landis' son, Matt, who is about to turn 40. His employer, Lincoln Benefit Life, announced up to 1,100 job cuts over the next 2 years. That's a third of the insurance company's workforce.
So there was one big cut about a month ago or two that I thought I was a goner, and somehow or other have made it through that with a heck of a lot of gratitude.
Especially since he and his wife just had their first child 2 weeks ago. Matt is now watching to see if the economy provides an incentive to get back into the markets.
Buy low, sell high is what we've always been taught. And, you know, in a sense, this is one of our greatest opportunities that we've had in our lifetime, that this is an opportunity to take advantage of that prosperity once it comes back.
But 60-year-old dad Dave Landis, an urban planner with the city, says the damage has been so great that any rebound may be too little too late for him.
The older you get, a 6,500 Dow doesn't work. You put in money at 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12, and you've taken your savings and cut it in half over time.
And for wife Melody, that's meant a wholesale shift in plans.
I still want to retire.
how much has that been affected by the downturn?
It's absolutely the difference. I would be retired right now. I lost a lot of money in my 401k. I lost 2/3 of it.
Both Melody and Dave say they're worried they'll eventually have to rely on help from Melissa and Matt, their children, which is something they never imagined they'd have to do. And they say the biggest factor, with their nest eggs so depleted, is health care.
The only way it works is if we retire, live modestly, and then just
drop dead.
And then drop dead without even bothering going to the hospital. Do not pass go, and just plant them in a cigar box and you're done.
But for all the concerns brought about by the recession, This family believes it's still lucky.
My grandfather had four sons that were in World War II, and he used to say, I can't be so lucky as to have all my kids survive the war. And they did. In a sense, from where we were 6 months ago, so far we've all dodged a bullet.
And with that, they knocked on the wooden table and got up to do the dishes. In Lincoln, Nebraska, I'm Tess Vigeland from Marketplace.
And I'm Amy Scott in Charlotte. It's a little before 10 a.m., and a group of mostly retired and semi-retired folks files into a Panera Bread.
Happy Easter.
This is an almost daily ritual. They meet here after church, drinking coffee from personalized mugs and talking politics and investments. A framed photo and news clipping about the group hangs above their regular table. When I last met up with them 6 months ago, the stock market had begun its steady dive. Back then, retired labor mediator Bob Brown was feeling lucky he'd sold out just after the Dow hit its peak above 14,000. That was in the fall of 2007.
Well, I guess the Holy Spirit told me to take my money out of the stocks and put it in CDs and stuff. And thank God I didn't put it into an AIG or something.
Boy, was he right about that. Since we last talked, analysts say more than $1 trillion in retirement savings has evaporated. Now, with stocks recovering a bit in the last month, Brown is thinking about tiptoeing back into the market. Don Brown sits a few seats down. He's a business owner and not related to Bob. He's kept playing in the market throughout the downturn, making bets like this one.
$3.50 for Bank of America. It's up to $9 now. You know, that was a pretty good risk.
Jane Francisco is done taking risks. She's a retired teacher living on Social Security and her pension. She says she was losing sleep watching more than $20,000 vanish from her retirement savings. That was about 20%. So a few months ago, Francisco and her husband pulled out what was left and put it in the bank.
I need to hold on to what I worked so hard for. It was a great sting to me to realize that, and I guess realizing that I've never had money, but for the first time I did, and how quickly it can just slip through your fingers.
Francisco says she even considered keeping her money in a safe at home. At the other end of the table, Rhea Caldwell lost money in the market as well. She teaches math at a private school.
I'll probably have to work till I'm 80 now to make up for all the money that we lost in the pension funds, but it's coming back.
It's not lost. It's just we're waiting for it to come back.
Rhea's husband, Bob, reminds her they won't actually lose the money until they sell, and they haven't sold yet. Caldwell owns a business building shipping containers. He says the downturn has helped his business some. His biggest customers are tire companies.
Most people are keeping their cars. They're fixing the old ones, and they have to put new tires on it. So the tire companies are making tires as fast as they can. So I'm seeing a very steady first quarter.
In Charlotte overall, the job market is far from steady. The unemployment rate has reached close to 12%. When I was here last, one of the group had just been laid off from her insurance job. She's now back at work part-time. Maybe it's the wisdom of their years or their Christian faith, but this is a pretty optimistic bunch. Again, Jane Francisco.
This is the security of having friends and support and just knowing that, you know, these people are here for you it's so comforting.
They'll continue to ride out the recession together every morning over coffee. In Charlotte, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up, taxes and the cheater within.
We have to pay taxes, and we realize it. We also realize that it's good to pay taxes at some level because the government does all kinds of things for us. At the same time, we have our selfish desires to pay as least as possible.
But first, let's do the numbers. All right, so back to that metaphor we opened with. Wall Street skeptics who saw a glass half empty today and decided to pour out a little more. They sent the Dow Industrial sliding 137 points, almost 1.75%, closed back below the 8,000 level yet again, specifically 7,920. The NASDAQ tumbled 27 points, 1.75%, finished at 1625. The S&P 500 carved off 17 points, an even 2%, wrapped up trading at 841. Financial stocks fell back out of favor. Shares of Goldman Sachs suffered their worst loss in nearly 3 months, dropping almost 12%. Goldman flooded the market with 40 million shares in a bid to raise cash, as we told you about yesterday. American Express fell almost 10%. J.P. Morgan Chase pulled back nearly 9% today. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. Now you can take Marketplace with you wherever you go. Tap in marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest business news, decoders that explain financial terms, and updates on the economic crisis.
On the Marketplace State Book, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the Consumer Price Index for March. The Federal Reserve Board publishes its latest Beige Book summary of current economic conditions. And though the economic news of the times may get you down, you don't have to appear upset about it, thanks to Botox. On April 15, 2002, the FDA approved it to treat frown lines. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The start of the German corn planting season is just days away, and that makes the issue of what farmers there can actually put in the ground somewhat more urgent. This morning, the German government banned a particular strain of genetically modified corn that's manufactured by the U.S. biotechnology firm Monsanto. The technical name for it is MON-810, but more to the point, Monsanto's sales pitch is that it's resistant to something called the corn borer caterpillar. The German government prefers to put it this way, that the product presents a danger to the environment. From the Marketplace European Desk in London, Stephen Beard reports.
MON-810 is Monsanto's foot in the door in Europe. It's the only GM crop the EU has approved for commercial use. But Germany has now joined France, Greece, Austria and Hungary and banned it. Anti-GM campaigners across the continent are rejoicing. Claire Oxborough of Friends of the Earth in Britain.
Well, this is fantastic news. This is part of a growing political movement now against GMOs, which is now following the public opposition that there's always been in Europe.
But GM supporters claim that Europe is still divided over the issue. Professor Vivian Moses of a British group called CropGen.
There are countries, Spain and the Czech Republic, which are growing these materials already, and Slovakia and Portugal. So it's not as if Europe is unitary in its rejection.
Monsanto said today that it was disappointed by the German decision, which it described as unscientific. But spokesman Lee Quarles denied that the company would suffer any financial hardship as a result of the German ban.
Europe actually doesn't factor into our financial models simply because of the very action that was taken today. It's a highly unpredictable, uncertain marketplace that does not appear to have a functioning regulatory system.
Nevertheless, the anti-GM campaigners are still rejoicing. They claim that European resistance to GM crops is growing, and that is sending a signal around the world warning about the potential dangers of this technology. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
When the 16th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States was enacted, the one that allows for personal income tax, tax day was March 1st. So if you look at it that way, you've been able to hang on to the money you'll have to hand over to the IRS tomorrow, an extra 6 weeks. The other way to look at it, of course, is that taxes are due tomorrow. We've got behavioral economist Dan Ariely on the line once again to talk about our deeply conflicted relationship with the Internal Revenue Code. Dan, good to talk to you.
Same here.
If ever there was a topic that rolled behavioral and economics all into one, it is taxes, because really you don't want to pay them. What is the temptation here to maybe not pay taxes and cheat a little bit?
Taxes, especially with the American system, is kind of a good test case for cheating, where we have to pay taxes and we realize it. We also realize that it's good to pay taxes at some level because the government does all kinds of things for us. At the same time, we have our selfish desires to pay as least as possible. And the tax code lets us play tricks with ourselves. So imagine you went out for dinner with your aunt and she asked you how work was going. And you said, oh, it was going well. And she gave you some suggestions about work. Can you now charge it as a business expense?
That's right. That's right.
How about if you went golfing with somebody who might appear on the show at some point? Me, for example. You know, can you charge this?
One can only hope.
So it's actually very, very tricky. And all this ability to change things make it very fuzzy. In fact, Will Rogers said that the income tax has made liars of more Americans than even golf.
What about the current economic climate? Will that make it more likely for people to want to just save a little bit and maybe not give it to the government?
That's a very crucial topic for the IRS this year. Every year, the IRS kind of think that they're gaining a slightly lower level of compliance. And every year, there's a sliding scale in which this number increases a little bit. And this year in particular, it's a question of how much will it increase. And here's the story. If we can justify it, if we can say, oh, the government is just terrible, they're giving all these bonuses away, they're spending my tax money, that might actually create a situation in which we're more willing to bend the rules.
Hmm.
There's one more crucial, interesting part here, which is what is the role of accountants? Imagine that you did it yourself, and you had to write the numbers in, and you have to declare all the amounts and so on.
I can't because my wife won't let me. But anyway, go ahead.
Oh, imagine your wife is doing it, and she's writing all the numbers versus you putting all the receipts in a shoebox and you're sending it to your accountant.
Right.
Under which of those things would you feel more comfortable slipping a few extra receipts?
Well, yeah, doing it myself, of course, right?
No.
Because nobody else knows.
So it turns out that that's not the answer. It turns out that if you do it yourself, you kind of feel morally responsible.
Oh.
But if somebody else is eventually going to sign and you leave it to somebody else's discretion, now you feel, oh, let me try this thing and the accountant will tell me if it's right or wrong. And that's basically what we call diffusion of responsibility.
Yeah, see, I'd be afraid of getting caught, though, which is why I'm going to pay my taxes anyway. But would we get better participation from the American public if we cut out the annoyance and just made it some flat 22.5% tax and be done with it?
I think so. I think people would be happier. And the other interesting thing about it is that I like the American tax system in principle. Once a year, you sit, you look at your income, you look at your taxes, you think you're participating in some civil engagement in which you are part of society and you're contributing your share. But the way we're doing it, it's not helpful at all. You don't feel more like part of the American society. You just feel annoyed and that they're taking your money and so on. It would have been a good, interesting exercise to try and say, how would we create a civil engagement exercise out of this? So, for example, imagine that I would say, you know what, 10% of your taxes, you could decide how it goes. You can decide if you want to send it on education, roads, military, transportation, whatever you decide, alternative energy. And the question is, will that actually create more civil engagement? People would care more, think more, and actually maybe contribute more.
Something to think about on Tax Day tomorrow from Dan Ariely. He teaches behavioral economics at Duke University. His book is called Predictably Irrational.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, another dispatch from the front edges of economic innovation. Folks behind the X Prizes, the ones for a car that gets more than 100 miles to the gallon or for building a private spaceship, they rolled out another one today, $10 million for health care. The bar is pretty high, it seems, if not entirely well-defined, raising the overall health of a community of 10,000 people 50% in 3 years. If you want to try, you've got 18 months to submit your ideas. Perhaps not coincidentally, we should mention, the contest is being co-sponsored by WellPoint, the health insurance company. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Tuesday afternoon. Today, the Dow slid 137 points, almost 1.75%, closed at 79.20, the blue chips did. The NASDAQ declined 27 points, 1.75%, ended at 16.25. The S&P 500 shed 17 points, 2%, ended at 8.41. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Renita Jablonski on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Coming up next time on this program, last fall we were in Youngstown, Ohio, where the local GM plant was adding a third shift.
It's really a big boost. I forget how many hundreds of millions they said that would bring into the economy just with the third shift being added, because they do get some nice paychecks out there.
6 months later, we will go back out on the road to ruin and see Youngstown and see what's changed. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.